www.wbur.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Men have Viagra and Cialis and Levitra. Now women may be on their way to a sex drug of their own. If approved by the FDA, the testosterone patch Intrinza would be the first treatment on the market for female sexual dysfunction. Today, the FDA said more tests are needed, but Procter & Gamble is eager to sell the patch. Advocates call it a godsend for women who have lost interest in sex after menopause or a hysterectomy, a much-needed alternative to trading in sex for warm, G-rated embraces. But critics say that more drugs, more testosterone, may not be the best answer for women, that the drug companies just want a piece of a $3 billion a year market and a female version of the Viagra bonanza. Tonight on Point, the sex patch for women and the medicalizing of sex in America. You can join the conversation. Will you be celebrating the arrival of a sex patch for women? And if Viagra is good for men, is the patch good for women? Or is society fighting nature too hard when it comes to sex these days? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Allison Fass, senior reporter for Forbes magazine, who's been reporting on the female sex patch Intrinza. Allison, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Give us the background on this. The FDA met today and said they don't have enough information to be sure that this hormone patch is safe over long-term use in reviving women's libido. What's
right.
The background here? Who's developing this? Why? What's the impetus?
Well, the Intrinza patch has been developed by Procter & Gamble in conjunction with a patch-making company called Watson Pharmaceuticals, and they've been working on it for quite some time, a few years, in fact. And the trial data that they presented to the FDA was 2 6-month studies, which apparently the advisory panel today did not think was lengthy enough or that enough women had been involved.
Allison, how does this patch work? What does it do?
The patch transmits testosterone into the woman's body much like the ovaries would if they were intact. The Intrinza patch so far has only been tested in women whose ovaries have been removed, so therefore their testosterone levels are low.
And by transmitting testosterone, there's a direct connection between testosterone and sexual desire?
That's correct. That's what they have found, that there may indeed be a connection between testosterone levels and sexual desire. And the results so far, though, may only be minimal compared to the risks involved with taking, hormone replacement therapy.
What kind of risks might be involved?
That's a good question, Tom. For one thing, there are side effects with taking testosterone. Like, women have found that they grow facial hair or their voice may lower slightly.
Okay.
But the risks could be even more than that. There could be risks of cardiovascular disease, which is something the FDA does not want to, go near, considering the recent Vioxx recall.
Now, Procter & Gamble is interested here. They do things on a very big scale. They must have seen what's going on with all the sexual dysfunction drugs for men, just enormous markets there. We
yes.
read 30 million American women will have gone through menopause by 2005, and another 10 million will be menopausal because of having their ovaries removed. Is that the market? Are we talking about tens of millions of women, potentially?
Well, the market's really smaller than that because while there may be 10 million women who've gone through menopause, they are not all having problems with low desire.
So it's, we remember with Viagra, Allison, yes. that it began, it seemed it was going to be targeted at a very specific group of men who had
right.
specific complications resulting from prostate surgery, whatever it might be. And now it's all over the Internet. It seems like people buy it recreationally. Presumably Procter & Gamble has a substantial market in mind if they're putting this big push in.
Right now they're going after, or at the beginning, they'll be going after a smaller group of people than ultimately the number of people who might be interested, whose interest might be piqued at words like female Viagra and increased sexual desire. So, who they say they're targeting and who the women that are in their trials may not actually be the indicate how large the number of people who might be interested in, and also likewise may use this patch recreationally.
You, working for Forbes magazine and following the business dynamics of this, you must have seen a huge interest on the male side. I mean, it's just turned into a giant market.
Yes, it's a giant market. And there could be, even in fact, more women who suffer from low desire than the men who suffer from erectile dysfunction. But it's all about creating a market. So there are a lot of, you know, Procter & Gamble knows how to market market products. They'll probably know how to market drugs.
Well, I was going to ask you that. I mean, that is their biggest claim to fame. They can take any kind of soap and turn it into a household brand.
Yeah.
With that, they've changed all kinds of American behaviors and impressions about the world.
Mm-hmm.
If P&G goes to work on women of a certain age or in certain medical circumstances, do they have the marketing clout to just change the way people, women in their 50s and their 60s think about what their sex lives ought to be?
I mean, certainly. I mean, just talking about us having a conversation right now on the radio about female sexual dysfunction, you know, lightens the seriousness and makes it less taboo to talk about. So, you know, Procter & Gamble coming out with a product and having ads on television or in magazines or newspapers, it gets the word out and it makes women more interested and more likely to talk about this with their doctor.
A potential very big business here.
Mm-hmm.
Allison Fass, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Allison Fass, senior reporter for Forbes magazine. We're joined now from Chicago by Dr. Laura Berman. She's director of the Berman Center, a health center for women focused on sexual health and menopause management. She's clinical assistant professor of OBGYN and psychiatry at Northwestern University. Dr. Berman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Happy to be here.
And with us from Cleveland, Ohio, Jennifer Fishman, assistant professor of bioethics and sociology at Case Western Reserve University. Jennifer Fishman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to just dive in and get the reaction of each of you to what appears to be unfolding. The FDA has put up a spanner in the works today, but if we've seen how these things work before, there seems to be a very good chance that this will eventually come to the market. Laura Berman, what do you think of the push to get, you know, sex enhancement drugs to women? Is this a vital need that the American pharmaceutical industry is filling, or are we redefining sexual activity, need, desire, standards?
Well, first of all, the FDA had a lot more to lose than to gain with this case, especially in the wake of the whole Vioxx fiasco. And
they're feeling very careful right now.
And as well they should be. Yeah. I hope they're this careful with every drug that they approve. I mean, it's important to be careful and to look at the health risks and benefits and to make sure that you have data to support both. So, you know, that's totally appropriate. Whether there is a need for medications to treat sexual dysfunction, I say absolutely. That's not to say that there is going to be one magic pill or one magic patch that is going to cure all that ails women sexually, in particular with low desire, because it's extremely complex, especially for women. There are always emotional and relationship issues that play a role in a woman's libido, how she feels about herself, her body, her history, whether she likes her partner or not, how she sexually responds, all play a role. But there are millions of women out there, and I certainly hear from thousands of them on a weekly and monthly basis, who are struggling with sexual dysfunction, the most common complaint of which is low desire, and it's affecting very deeply their quality of life. Now, I would, from my clinical experience, probably only a third of those women who present to me with low desire have low testosterone, and even when they have low testosterone, they also have emotional and relationship challenges that need to be dealt with simultaneously. But the good news is that if this eventually gets approved, which I hope it will, then we'll be able to address the medical piece of the puzzle in addition to the emotional and relationship pieces that are impacting on women's sex lives.
Jennifer Fishman, you've looked at sexuality in a historical context as well. What do you see in the training of all this pharmaceutical effort on the sex lives of Americans? I guess in a way it's the same question. Is there an urgent need that this is requiring, that this is addressing here, or are we redefining sexuality to make markets?
Right. I think that's a very good question. I think we need to look at why this drug is appearing now in this time and place, you know, in light of the availability of Viagra and in light of the idea that there is a large market of women out there that could either benefit from this drug or for whom the pharmaceutical company could market this drug to. And I think we do need to look historically that, you know, our understanding of female sexual desire in our society has fluctuated dramatically. You know, we used to think of women that they did not have any innate sexual desire, and if they did, they were sometimes labeled as nymphomaniacs.
Right.
So we like to think that our understanding has evolved, but it's important to recognize that our contemporary notions of sexuality are just as culturally and historically contingent in some ways. So why do we think we know so much more now that this is indeed a biological problem, a medical problem? And what happens when we take something that was outside of the realm of medicine and bring it under the rubric of medicine and under the rubric of the pharmaceutical industry?
Laura Berman, I wish you'd describe for us from your practice at the Berman Center the kinds of circumstances that women come in with that leave them with low sexual desire, low enough that they're feeling dissatisfied with it.
What's the criteria that has to exist in order for a woman to be considered appropriate for any kind of treatment for sexual dysfunction is that it has to be something that causes her personal distress. And that can be quite complicated when it comes to low desire, because a woman who has low desire will, you know, if she lives alone and has no partner, she's perfectly content. If she has a partner and she has a relationship, it's impacting on her intimacy, her connection, and very often it also impacts on her self-esteem. So it's a little bit more complex to measure personal distress in women with low desire than it is, for instance, in women with difficulty becoming aroused or with pain or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, you know, you mentioned Viagra, and is this just, you know, the pharmaceutical industry jumping on the bandwagon and trying to find something for women that's like Viagra was for men? First of all, I just want to say that that's never going to happen. There's never going to be a panacea for women because, as I said, we're too complex.
Right.
But secondly, I think what happened is that you had so many men reclaiming their sexuality through getting treated with Viagra, which resolves, you know, erectile dysfunction almost always, even in men with psychogenic erectile dysfunction or psychologically caused erectile dysfunction. So you have this huge population of men, many of whom who hadn't been sexually active with their partners for many years, suddenly able to function sexually, want to have sex, and then that's when a light bulb finally goes off and their partner realizes, you know, wait a minute, I'm not interested in
I'm not in the game. So,
you know, I'm no longer in this game.
So you say they're different, but there is a kind of upping the ante here. If the men are suddenly pharmaceutically turbocharged and the women just aren't in the arena.
But I don't know that they're turbocharged. Here's how I look at it, and I come from an anthropological background, so maybe that skews my perspective. But I'd like to look at things from an evolutionary perspective. And, you know, we were not intended to live well past our reproductive years, but thanks to modern medicine, we are living significantly longer and spending, and women are in the future are going to spend at least half of their lives or more in menopause. And so in the past, it didn't matter that our reproductive organs started to prolapse and fall, you know, after our childbearing years, because we were passed away. We were dead by them.
It didn't
matter that our testosterone wasn't there anymore and we had no desire. But today's generation of aging people, given modern medical technology, are very active, very vital, and want to live full, exciting, loving lives together. And so the pharmaceutical industry certainly has their own agenda and sees a marketplace there, but I think they're also meeting a need in that women are living so long in healthy and vital in other ways, and they want a healthy and vital sex life as well.
Jennifer Fishman, how about it? On television these days, we certainly see a lot of images of gray and white-haired Americans dancing cheek to cheek. if lifetime is a much longer thing, does it just make sense for medical science to help people sustain their sex lives more deeply into it?
Right. It does raise a question about what role medicine is supposed to play in all of this, in things like quality of life and in lifestyle conditions. You know, there definitely is the idea with aging baby boomers and people entering menopause now that they don't want to give up anything as they get older, that aging might be okay, but it shouldn't come with any kinds of diminishment of anything that they had in their lives previously. And so anything that they can do to help themselves feel as good as they did when they were younger seems okay. And whether medicine wants to get into that business or not, you know, is, I think, a question that we want to ask ourselves. You know, is it the FDA's job to say, to promote that kind of activity?
Well, medicine as an industry clearly wants to get into it.
Absolutely.
When and how for women, I guess, is the subject tonight. Jennifer Fishman, Laura Berman, please stand by. It's great to have you both tonight. We are talking about the sex patch for women and the medicalizing of sex in America. We really want to hear what you have to say. Are you celebrating the prospect of a female sex drive enhancer, or scratching your head at where we're going here? If Viagra is good for men, is the patch good for women? Is it only fair?
Or is society fighting nature too hard when it comes to sex these days? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sex patch for women. Procter & Gamble wants to come out with a new patch that would impart testosterone to women with low sexual desire. The testosterone, if it works, would pump it up. The FDA today said not yet. More testing's required, but clearly there's a big interest in getting this up and on the rails. Viagra's been a bonanza for the pharmaceutical industry. A lot of women make up a potential market for this drug as well. What do you think? Does the sex patch address an urgent need, or is this mainly another profit center for the pharmaceutical companies? And is it wrong for a woman to be 50, 55, 60 and desire less sex? Is that a medical problem, or is it just life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Chicago by Dr. Laura Berman, director of the Berman Center and clinical assistant professor of OBGYN and psychiatry at Northwestern University, and from Cleveland by Jennifer Fishman, assistant professor of bioethics and sociology at Case Western Reserve. And right now, on the phone from Boston, Mary's calling. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Oh, would that be such a great, wonderful thing if they could do this? I'm 45 years old.
Yeah.
And I have been suffering from sexual dysfunction for at least 10 years, and it has caused a lot of problems with myself and my husband.
And does it feel like yours falls into this category of low drive, low desire, that kind of dysfunction?
Extremely, yeah, yeah.
So
and
if there...
And it's not because I'm missing my ovaries or anything like that. There just is no drive at all.
Mary, have you ever gone to the doctor and said, "Doctor, can you help me?" And he said, "No, there's no drug for that"?
Well, I've been tested to find out if my testosterone level, what it was.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, no, that falls within levels of where it's supposed to be. Well, I would rather risk having the hair. You can deal with that.
Right, right.
Electrolysis works for that, right?
Right, off it goes. And how big an issue for your marital relationship is this?
It's extremely big. It's been a really severe problem emotionally for both of us.
So when you hear us talking about, you know, agonizing over whether this is medicalizing sex, that's not your concern. You're saying, let's go.
Yeah, just go ahead and do it. There's way too many women who have a problem and need to be able to be sexual with their partners.
And just don't have the drive to do it. Mary, thanks very much for your call. Laura Berman, that seems to resonate with what you've described as hearing from people who come into your center. Give us the breakdown again between psychological reasons and medical or biological reasons.
It's hard to break down. As in, you know, in Mary's case, I don't remember how old she said she
45.
She 45. So when a woman reaches perimenopause, I mean, she's been struggling with this for 10 years, which means that it started before that. But when a woman reaches perimenopause, her testosterone levels have often, you know, our testosterone levels slowly decline throughout our lifespan. And so by the time a woman is in perimenopause, her late 30s, early 40s, she'll often start to recognize the symptoms of low testosterone, which are obviously low desire, but also low energy and poor general sense of well-being. And to take it a step further, because there's been such controversy about testosterone replacement in women, the laboratories who look at the serum levels, the blood levels of testosterone in patients don't really have a consensus. So one lab will say one thing's normal, another lab will say something else is normal, and there are huge ranges. So I see many patients whose doctors have told them, oh, yeah, you're normal, and it's because they don't, you know, normal, schmormal, but, you know, their levels are so-called normal, if there's such a thing. I have found that many of the women who come in who have been told by their doctors that their levels are fine, when we look at those levels, they're really not fine, and they're actually quite low. So it's something that, you know, in 1953, testosterone was approved for men, and it's something that has been used as an off-label prescription for years in women in the form of, you know, compounding pharmacists have compounded it for physicians prescribing it for years.
And Jennifer Fishman, let me ask you, when you hear Mary making her case there, really a kind of a plea, she doesn't care if this is part of a medicalizing of sex. She feels like she's got a problem. She'd like something to help her solve it. Who's to say she shouldn't have it if it's safe?
Right, absolutely. I don't argue that this isn't a real problem for a lot of people, right, that this isn't a real condition and that this doesn't actually exist. My concern is more with what kinds of expectations does it create for women at large, for every woman, for every man, about what it means to be a sexual being and what it means to be normal in this society.
Is there evidence, I guess, I don't know who to put this to, but is there evidence that, I mean, you said before that all the images are of longer life and of longer sexual activity, but is there a point at which in marriages couples mutually agree that there's a kind of, less heat in the oven and that's okay? Laura Borman?
Well, I mean, I think there are plenty of couples who very successfully accomplish that, and those aren't couples for whom treatment is appropriate. It's those couples who are struggling with this and those women for whom it's affecting their quality of life that are really the candidates for treatment. You know, this is something I'm a sex therapist by training, and so I believe very deeply in the important role that sexuality plays in people's lives. Mm. And what I see in couples is that when sex is working in the relationship, it's a nice part of a great relationship, but it's not the key element. When it's not working in a relationship, it becomes a huge pink elephant in the room, and it really starts to fray the fiber of the connection between two couples. So they'll have a shorter threshold for anger. They won't get along as well. They'll feel like roommates more than partners.
Right.
They're more susceptible to affairs. You know, everything starts to break down.
But do you worry that for those who might have reached a kind of plateau that they were mm-hmm. happy with and satisfied with, I mean, and then bless them, one and all, whichever way it is, but are they being defined out of acceptability by the marketing that goes on around sex drugs?
I certainly hope not. I mean, my idea of what the message should be, and who am I? I mean, Procter & Gamble isn't going to necessarily listen to me when they market this. But my feeling of how it should be is that, you know, if this is something that the bottom line is that if this is something that is affecting your quality of life and your relationship and how you feel about yourself, there is a potential that there's help available. And as I said, this isn't going to be a patch that makes every woman's sexual dreams come true. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not going to be a magic bullet, not nearly to the extent that Viagra has been for men, to be quite honest.
Yeah, it's a much more complicated business, as you say.
It absolutely is.
Judy's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
You know, I listened to the story, Mary's story, and I certainly feel for Mary, but I'm an oncology nurse.
Okay.
And my expertise is taking care of women with breast cancer.
Yeah.
And after the whole HRT fiasco that just went on where they finally did a randomized trial, I can't help feeling that a patch of testosterone is just another hormone that's going to increase one's long-term risk of developing breast cancer.
So you say, look what happened with estrogen, let's not go down that road again with testosterone.
Plus, you know, in a postmenopausal woman, which will be the target population, I'm sure, that will
sure.
be marketed to, there are other organs, such as the adrenal gland, that produces testosterone. And testosterone is converted into estrogen by an enzyme known as aromatase.
Okay.
What will this do to that whole mechanism of converting testosterone to estrogen? And what will that bump up in estrogen mean as an increased long-term risk for breast cancer?
So, bravo if it would work, but you're concerned it may come around and bite women with other effects, breast cancer
well,
in particular.
Well, you know, we've been bitten before
yeah.
by several different, you know, over the years.
There's no kidding.
And I can't help feeling that this is just going to be another whole thing that's going to go on for women and another can of worms. And again, I'm all for quality of life. I'm just as concerned as a nurse, but I can't help feeling that this is going to be an issue.
Yeah. Judy, stick with us for a minute.
Yep.
Laura Borman, how about that? You know, no one wants to get people over a barrel where they're facing, okay, we made a lifestyle change, but we've also got cancer now.
Well, there were actually some breast cancer groups that were lobbying against this patch being approved by the FDA for just that reason. There was a concern, and as she said, she's absolutely right, that testosterone can theoretically, if the levels get too high, start being converted into estrogen. And if you have an estrogen-fed breast cancer or had one, then that's not a good thing. And for the most part, any clinician who prescribes testosterone, knows that it's contraindicated in a woman with a breast cancer history. At the same time, we see women at the Berman Center all the time who are breast cancer survivors 5 years, 10 years out, and they say, look, you know, for so long my doctor has been telling me you're lucky to be alive. You know,
right,
this is
right.
about quantity of life. Well, you know what? I've been living a miserable life in my relationship. I've been living a miserable life in my body. It's about quality of life as well.
So help
and
me.
I understand what the risks are, mm-hmm. and I want to take them, and I'll sign away my firstborn child or whatever else I need to do to keep you from being legally responsible for this. But this is affecting my quality of life, and it's time that I do something about it. And I think that women, if they have the information and they know what the risks are, that we should give them the right to make the choice about, even if they are breast cancer survivors. I certainly am very queasy and don't condone giving a breast cancer survivor testosterone or any other hormone. You know, one more point very quickly regarding the Women's Health Initiative. We sort of, the media has kind of released those results piecemeal,
right,
making it seem like there are all these different studies going on when really all the results were from one study. And it actually was a pretty fatally flawed study because they looked at women who had been postmenopausal they were in their 60s, postmenopausal, and had never been on estrogen of any sort. And when they looked at the observation group, which was a younger population of women, they noticed a decrease in risk in many risk factors and actually improvement in symptoms. So I think, there are many people out there that are advocating for that study to be redone or similar studies to be done because the public has been misled to just wholeheartedly dismiss hormone replacement when I don't know that that's necessarily the best or the right thing to do.
But meanwhile, our caller Judy, the oncology nurse, says be careful.
Absolutely.
Because
I
agree with that. The other end it can be bitter tears. Judy, thank you for your call. I want to turn now to Gina Ogden. She joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's a marriage and family therapist, a certified sex therapist, author of Women Who Love Sex, an inquiry into the expanding spirit of women's erotic experience. Gina Ogden, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
You've heard the conversation. You see the news. Sex drug for women that will pump up the drive with a testosterone patch. You look at the almost spiritual aspects of this. What do you think of it? Do you welcome it? Do you fear it?
Well, I do look at the spiritual aspects. In fact, I did a huge study on sexuality and spirituality, the first that's ever been done nationwide. And what I found was really quite interesting because in my study of almost 4,000 people, the older people got, and most of the respondents were women, the more that they connected spiritual issues with their sexual desire. And
of course, if you don't have any desire, there's nothing to connect those to.
Well, you also have to ask, desire for what? Is it desire for intercourse?
Mm-hmm.
Is it desire for affection? Is it desire for closeness? Is it desire for love? And one of the big findings that I had was that what really turned women on to wanting sex was sharing deep feelings with their partners, was feeling safe, was being able to ask for what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and I don't think you get those with a testosterone patch.
There's no substitute for that. On the other hand, if you have a physical impairment, that means there's no desire in the first place. You get cut off from that. So do you see a place, coming at it from your angle, do you see a place for a kind of a chemical help here, or does that somehow flaw the spiritual part of this?
I don't think that there's a fight between chemical help and spirituality. I think, in fact, they're probably all connected. I think what is dangerous is the way that this patch is probably going to be marketed, not just for women who come into the Berman Center saying that they'll sell their firstborn child to have sexual desire, but it will be out there to set a new standard for women that not only do they have to be multiply orgasmic, but now they have to have this drop-dead desire.
Yeah.
And we've got this terrific double message out there already. I mean, suppose we have a desire patch, but we also have millions and millions of dollars that are funding abstinence-only groups.
Now, but not among 50-somethings.
Well, but the 50-year-olds, women typically in this culture become sexually invisible. And in fact, on NPR, possibly on your station several years ago, I heard a wonderful actress, Julia Harris, say, after 50, We become women of glass. Men look right through us.
Well, I think we can count on, if this drug is approved and the marketing machine revs up, that will change. The images will be very different. We've got a lot more to get into here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Camille is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Camille. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks. What's on your mind, Camille?
I am 56, and about 5 or 6 years ago, I had a hysterectomy and had my ovaries removed.
Okay.
No cancer history anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was put on hormone replacement therapy with estrogen, which worked fine for what estrogen is good for. However, I had no sex drive.
Okay.
And this was a real problem at the time with me and my boyfriend.
Sure.
And so I was changed to a drug called EstraTest, which includes estrogen and testosterone, small dose. I had a sex drive again, and that was really nice to have. And then when my boyfriend and I broke up, I went back to my doctor and said, well, I don't need testosterone anymore. And went back on plain estrogen, and, you know, it's really nice now not to have a sex drive.
No boyfriend, no sex drive, no problem.
Right, as opposed to, you know, 10 years ago when I had no boyfriend, and I did have ovaries, and I did have a sex drive.
Well, let me ask you about that, Camille. I mean, that makes it sound like the ideal is to be able to kind of turn it on or let it turn off depending on your circumstances in life. Is that what you want, or is there something special about just following nature, whether nature's got you tuned up high or turned down low?
Well, I mean, once you're past menopause and once you, or if you don't have ovaries, you really don't, you know, you, unless you replace it, you don't have it.
Right.
Before then, I mean, you don't have a choice. You basically have a sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
And
so,
at this point, I do have a choice, and I'm glad, actually. And if I have a boyfriend again, I will want testosterone again.
Sounds like a market for the patch of one right there. Camille, thanks very much for your candor, and thanks for calling us. Jennifer Fishman, that seems to be, you know, in a nutshell. I mean, no boyfriend, no sex drive, that's okay. But when there's a need, Camille wants to be, you know, ready.
Right. It's the ultimate use of a lifestyle drug. You get it when you want it, and you don't have to have it when you don't.
So here we are. We're in the scientific age, the technological age, the get what you want when you want it age.
Mm-hmm.
Is right or wrong an issue here, or are those just irrelevant concepts around this?
Right. I don't think there's a right or a wrong here. I think that more interesting questions revolve around, you know, why now? Right? What is it about our society now that encourages this kind of behavior? So we can look at issues like we've already talked about, issues of people living longer and of baby boomers having different expectations than they used to.
Laura Berman, I know I've just got you for a few more seconds. What's your guess here? If you look 5 or 10 years out, are we going to see men and women both, you know, equipped with drugs to make it happen?
Better loving through chemistry. You know, I think for men it will always be much easier than it is for women. And what I hope for is that we will have medical options available to address solely the medical causes for sexual dysfunction, and that obviously sex is always going to be part of a bigger picture of emotional and relationship issues and how a woman feels about herself and her body and her knowledge and her expectations. But, you know, it's up to a woman to choose the way she wants to live her life and her sexual life, and we should make those options available to her.
Laura Berman in Chicago, we've got to let you go. I know. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sex patch for women. Not on the market yet. The FDA today said, more research, please. But it looks like it's coming. It's got giant Procter & Gamble behind it. You can imagine what comes next. Joining us tonight from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Gina Ogden. She's a marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist, author of Women Who Love Sex. And from Cleveland, Ohio, Jennifer Fishman, assistant professor of bioethics and sociology at Case Western Reserve University. You can join us as well. Does this have the market potential to be the next Viagra, or are women a different kind of consumer? And if the FDA gives the green light, will you be lining up to buy the patch? And this, I guess, do we now have to be sexy until we're dead? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Yogesh is calling from Boston. Hi, Yogesh. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a comment and a question.
Yeah.
What I've seen, I'm a doctor, and what I've seen over the last few years is that most medical releases start for seemingly legitimate purposes, and the indications to broaden to include questionable purposes. For example, Viagra started to help men with sexual dysfunction.
Right.
Eventually became the a party drug of America. Growth hormone started for replacing hormonal deficiencies, but now every kid who's short in school who wants to get into a basketball team is attempting to take growth hormone with very little evidence that can prove to it. Now, looking at the Viagra controversy as well, my point is, are we better off doing management by proactive research or management by autopsy? In other words, who's going to police if this is released to the general public from its indiscriminate use?
Given the patterns you've seen with these other drugs, if the sex patch for women comes on the market and it's initially tightly focused on a certain, you know, percentage of women with particular problems, as a doctor who's watched these other drugs, what do you imagine will happen here or might?
Right, and who's going to police all this?
Yeah, policing, I guess, once it's gone, in a way, it's gone. Jennifer Fishman, what about it? I mean, does it become another party drug? It makes you wonder, you know, who's going to buy this? Is it women or is it men? You know, a 12-pack for
right.
Valentine's Day.
The caller raises very interesting points, and it's something that researchers have long looked at. It's this idea of what some have called diagnostic bracket creep, the way in which a diagnostic category can expand, and it especially happens when pharmaceutical companies are trying to maintain their market or maintain their profit share. So we've seen it happen in the case of Ritalin and attention deficit disorder,
right.
And also most commonly with use of SSRIs such as Prozac and Zoloft and clinical diagnoses of depression, anxiety disorders, and things like that. And then the caller raises yet another point, which is this idea of off-label usage or even non-prescription
sure.
use of these drugs, which I think are all very important things to consider. And I think that Intrinza, this testosterone patch, is mm-hmm. headed in the same direction.
Gina Ogden, what do you think? If this comes on the market, you know what happened with Viagra? It's all over the web now. People buy it everywhere. I don't know, a few years out, would we see the sex patch for women as a kind of fashion accessory peeking out from underneath, you know, your hip huggers?
Right. It would have to be in many colors. You raised a really interesting question. Are we supposed to be sexy until we're dead? And I want to say that we are. We just don't necessarily express it through intercourse or through the ways that that we think of as sexy.
Hmm.
You know, we have sexual energy. And I think that I'm not a medical person, and I do not know the ins and outs of the adrenal system. Well, I'm listening hard to everything that's being said.
Yeah.
But I do believe that we express our sexuality in a number of ways. And as some women, anyway, grow older, we may express it in ways that are not necessarily intercourse-related, genital-related, or even partner-related. We may become simply much more interested in other things.
That vibrancy can come out in lots of ways. But if
exactly, and if we try to medicalize it and channel it into what it was when we were 21, I think that could be a mistake. I'm not saying that. For one of the women who called Mary, I guess, 45, who said, "I really want it." Sure, if she wants to manage her sex life in that way, I think that's fine, that's an option.
But you know the power of marketing. If the whole society gets structured
exactly.
so that people feel that they've got to be, that the genitals are still the outlet for that vibrance, or they're somehow off the rails.
The market is already structured that way.
Yeah.
That's what you ask. You ask 100 people what they think sex is, and they're going to answer intercourse.
I mean, I'm all for it, but at the same time, there's a long tradition of other things emerging late in life that must have their own place. And you can't help wondering if maybe the drugs drive those out, don't leave room for different kinds of expression later.
I wonder. I'm certainly not interested in what I was interested in when I was 21.
Hey, try the patch. You might change your mind. I don't know.
Okay.
Susan's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that in a certain sense, in the PR sense, this is probably going to be a disaster for gullible women, because so far we've talked about women's biology and how women feel about themselves and their relationship with men.
Mm-hmm.
No one has mentioned that one reason why women don't have a whole lot of interest in sex is that their partners aren't very good lovers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Susan.
And if they've been with the same guy for a long time and the same guy was okay to begin with after 10, 20 years, he may be boring unless he's lively, and if he's been very average to begin with, it's fairly hopeless. And to automatically assume that a woman who has a low level of desire simply has a medical problem, it sure lets those guys off the hook. It's really, frankly, comical. I'm a psychologist, by the way.
We hear it loud and clear. I'm sure there's a lot of amens out there, Susan, and thanks for that. But Jennifer Fishman, how about it? That's not what this is intended for, but all through this conversation we're hearing this is a complicated puzzle here, and you can't just slap a patch on and solve it. Yet there's no patch you're going to slap on men to change them in mass either.
Right. That's a really good point. I think the caller brings up a really great point, which is that sexuality is intrinsically relational, right? It is by nature a very social thing, not a biological thing. It can never be simply a biological thing. We tend to do it with other people. So I think that she raises a really interesting point about why the patch won't solve our problems.
What's your sense, Dr. Fishman, of who's pushing the sex patch for women, men or women?
That is a really great question, and I don't think we know the answer to it yet. I have heard anecdotal evidence that, you know, this idea of personal distress, that women, when mm-hmm. they come into the doctor, they need to have personal distress. But it's very unclear whether they themselves have personal distress or whether they're distressed because their partner's distressed that they're not interested in sex. So it becomes, once again, it's this very complicated thing, not because women necessarily are so complicated, but because sexuality for both men and women is just such a complicated thing and involves other people and involves other people's feelings and emotions.
No kidding. Natalie's calling from Milwaukee. Natalie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, good to have you, Natalie.
My question, and what I'm really curious about, is how culture has had an effect on really giving women the green light to be much more assertive in their sexuality. It feels like we're living in this, you know, desperate housewives generation, which is, you know, for lack of a better term, but I'm just curious how much culture and society has had to influence women to really become much more empowering.
Natalie, let me ask you, do you feel empowered by that? Is a green light that you welcome, or do you feel compelled by that new sort of cultural norm?
Well, I think that, you know, so much that we see on TV, it's women taking control of their lives, becoming much more independent, and I think, you know, that's been a positive in a lot of ways, but I'm curious because we're talking so much more freely about women and their sexuality.
We sure are.
And, you know, I'm curious about how much that's influenced by things that we watch on TV and, you know, how much it has allowed us to speak freely about it.
It's a great question, Natalie. Thanks for your call. Gina Ogden, how about it? Do you see this freer conversation and all the images and all the messaging as liberating women's sexuality or somehow, you know, whipping it into regions where it wouldn't naturally go?
I think probably it's both. I mean, there's no question but that television shapes our culture as much as it reflects our culture. But, you know, when you get down to it, there's still the same old, what I call cultural missionary position, where man is on top, that there's an expectation that women are supposed to perform, and they're supposed to perform for their male partner.
But we thought that part of women's liberation was changing that dynamic so that, you know, women had an equal voice in that choir.
I think on paper women do have an equal voice, but look at the makeup of our government, look at the makeup of corporate America. And if you ask who's driving Intrinsa, I think it really is corporate America. I don't think it's men, and I don't think it's women.
But I hear more on the male side there of kind of driving the whole program, which may be sort of asking women to just dance to a faster fiddle tune here, whether they want to or not.
I think men are getting a bad rap here. I think both men and women get a bad rap from this kind of cultural missionary position, because it doesn't allow us to be equal and come from the place that we want to come, to be real partners. I mean, we need to partner together in order to save our planet, let alone have hot sex.
Well, amen to saving the planet and partnering too. This is On Point. Linda's calling from Egg Harbor, Wisconsin. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm a social psychologist, and I research and teach gender and self-esteem related issues. Mm-hmm. And one of my concerns has to do with the fact that, for example, the finding that within 10 minutes of women looking at fashion magazines like Vogue or something along those lines, their self-esteem severely drops. And when you look at women being presented as sex objects in the media, left and right, magazines, television, my concern is that women who don't need this drug for hormone replacement or something are going to be rushing to it, thinking that the women that are in the media images are sources of competition, that they're, you know, men are aroused by in their own presence. And I think that this undermines women's ability to find their own desire with their male partners when they're sitting in bed with their husband's arm around them and they're looking at some half-naked woman dancing around.
Yeah. Linda, stay with us. Jennifer Fishman, this seems to go right to what you talked about at the very beginning of the show, how our understanding of sexuality has changed over time. And it comes back to this issue of whether in a media age where we can constantly be bombarded with messages from on high, if the whole realm of sexuality can get torqued so high up that it's really not in alignment with a natural human attitude toward it.
Right. I sort of shun away from thinking about what is natural. We haven't been natural for many, many years.
Yeah, fair enough.
So it's always culturally mediated. But to insert a pharmacological treatment into that equation just seems strange, right? We know that these things are social and cultural, and they shift and they change as time goes on. And then to medicalize it, to say that this is indeed a biological problem, does definitely change things, and then would also change. Therefore, it also has an effect of changing our ideas about what sexuality is in exactly the way that the caller has described, this idea that, you know, we need this now in order to be attractive or desirable to our partners.
But what if you, in another 10 or 20 years, you know, feel the coals burning down and want that patch? Are you going to be restrained by a philosophical posture on it? Or?
Right. Well, I stand on my principles. That's a really good question.
And if you do, what will your significant other say?
We'll have to find out.
I guess so. Gina Ogden, you've been looking at this for a long time. How do you see this whole arena changing as we go forward into a more kind of chemically buttressed time? Are people becoming more comfortable with their sexuality or more uncomfortable?
I think it's still really hard for us to talk about sex, about what sex really is and what sex really means and what we want. The national conversation about sex is really very limited, if you think about it.
And you're saying when we don't talk about what it really is, you're coming back to your point that it is ultimately an ultimate intimacy.
I think that it is. It's a choice that each of us makes in our hearts. I think we're looking for heart-to-heart connection as well as body-to-body connection, that sex takes place in our minds, in our conversations, in how we contact people mentally, our partners mentally. It takes place between our ears as well as between our legs. And that we need to understand that sex is a whole person proposition. It's not just intercourse. It's not just genital. It's not just getting it on tonight, although there's nothing wrong with getting it on tonight.
And when the patch hits the shelves and somehow it feels inevitable even now, sooner or later, I guess that's the message that we're going to hear a lot more of. Gina Ogden, it's been wonderful having you tonight. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Gina Ogden, marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist, and Jennifer Fishman in Cleveland, Ohio, assistant professor at Case Western Reserve University. Wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for sharing with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.